Okay, we're sitting down this afternoon. This is Tuesday, October the... No, this isn't Tuesday. This is Wednesday.
October the 8th.
I'm sitting with Ken Tupling and Blake Constable, and we're talking about baseball and sports and graduate at West Palmer. Okay, Ken was speaking here about Kenny and his beginnings with baseball. So you were mentioning...
We had a minor team. I can't tell you what midget or what it was. In any event, Leighton Giffen and I coached the team to help out. And Mike went on and played in the Leaside Baseball League. And from there, a scout by the name of Prentice.
In Detroit.
Yeah, but he also played ball for Toronto in the big leagues as a relief pitcher. And he sort of looked after that Leaside League, scouted Mike, and Mike went through the process of getting up to Detroit Tigers.
Yeah.
And that's, he signed that picture.
Which diamond did you play on here?
Yeah.
Is that sun bothering you?
No, it's my eyes. I've had them on.
If you want to sit here.
No, I don't. Thanks very much.
George, if we just went around the subject of hardball. Ken, you'll remember Frank Hill well.
Sure.
He used to catch for me and miss a lot of third strike. But yeah. He was an active guy and a great curler.
Yes.
Anyway, his sister Margaret, Kell, married a chap from just north of Woodstock. And I happened to meet her at the Kell reunion twice this summer. And her grandson from her first marriage, because her first husband died, has been signed by, and I cannot remember which big league team. Was she ever excited about that?
Yeah.
He played in the big leagues?
Well, he's young. He may never make it to the top.
Today?
Yeah.
This
is just happening. It's her grandson.
Oh, heaven's sake.
So she wanted to tell me that, because, you know, I'd be interested. Was she ever excited about that?
Yeah.
So it's surprising what time unveils, isn't it?
Sure. Where would you play? Where would you play your games? Down here at the diamond.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Good. Mm-hmm. And you have lights at that time?
Yeah.
You would at that time.
Yeah. Mike was good. I could say more, but it might get out.
Well,
he may have been his own worst enemy.
Keith O'Kent was
the first one. Yeah, that would be Mike's grandfather.
Yeah.
And in a way, as a kid, because I was the youngest of a family of six, and I had four brothers that all played ball before I did. But anyway, I used, as a kid, from the time I was 4 or 5 years old, I was a spectator anyway, you know. But I can well remember Keith O'Kent pitching for Bradford at Churchill. I can remember the league, I think at that time, would be Bradford and Churchill. And for sure, it's been two different leagues. One would be Stroud, and I'm not sure about the other one. Later on, he's still pitching for Bradford. And there was a league composed of Churchill, Bradford, Newmarket, Aurora, and Richmond Hill. And that was roughly about 32. Mm-hmm. I'm just that much older than Ken. He would remember that.
No, we didn't come till 1945.
No.
And so I was not aware of that.
Yeah,
but I was aware of Mr. Kilkenny, because he pitched when I was here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he went a long time like I did. I pitched for 25 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, that's just a bit of history, which ties into some other stuff.
Well, it's kind of interesting because you mentioned that hardball. Because there's one here that you see, there's the earliest record that we have of baseball is the Newton Robinson Clippers.
Mm-hmm.
And they were played in 1888. And Lloyd Coburn, he used to catch for them,
mm-hmm.
and they were a hardball team.
Hardball,
yeah.
Is that so?
Yeah. And they hit Lloyd caught with nowhere to go.
Lloyd had a long history, I can tell you. They had played out the ball against Lloyd and the Cookstown. And Newton Robinson. Those were bigger than you.
Yeah.
And a great guy. He wouldn't be Lloyd Cole.
No. So that would be the same Lloyd that we knew?
I think it must have been his father.
This one, yeah.
If you're talking 18.
Yeah.
Well, right. But he confirmed like with us that this was a hardball team. He's been talking to Sarah Riley about it.
Is he like Coburn that we played Canada against still living?
Lives in what?
Jimmy Curry.
Lives in Guilford. Yeah.
But there was hardball around. See, we had a hardball team. I pitched ball things, and the team was only there for a year or two.
That was the same time that Churchill tried it, wasn't it? My brother.
I can't answer that.
You see, after I left Churchill, and Churchill wasn't doing as well in the South Simcoe League for a couple of years, they tried hardball at Churchill, and I'm wondering if it isn't the same era. Because
it could be, like.
I think it was Stroud and
then. But then there was.
Area,
there was a, yeah, Angus.
There was one in Beaton.
Everett. Everett
was a bugbear of hardball. Everett,
little
weird village.
A hardball town.
And it was the community of Knock also had one, and a hardball team.
Yeah, so way back.
Who, George?
Knock.
Knock.
K-N-O-C-K.
Knock is where I gave my historical speeches, too. But anyway, it was Knock.
Knock is about
public school.
The geographic middle of Inniscope County.
It's the ninth line on 10 side road.
Oh, okay.
Lots of memories of Knock.
Yeah, I never heard of it, you see.
Yeah.
And I remember they had, Beaton had a hardball.
Yeah, Beaton was hardball. Yeah.
Alliston?
A lot more hardball in Beaton than softball.
Yeah. Alliston had a team. Because when Bradford had the hardball team, we played them.
What was it that created the interest in baseball? What was it that created the interest in baseball?
Here?
Yeah. Well, that was in West Gwillimbury and like Fennels.
From my standpoint, from softball standpoint, the interest was already there when I came. We came in 1945.
And it was starting to bloom then. Allow me. It had waned before that. It waned seriously through the Depression.
Okay.
But you know, in the early 30s, and then towards the end of the 30s, before the Second Great War broke out, it started to strengthen. But then I say all this, and I know it recessed again because so many big farm communities, a lot of the boys had been called to service. The ones that weren't there were really needed on the farm, and it backed up until about 1944 again. And there was a different feeling then. Things were starting to happen. And 45, and then to the 50s, no television of any account. Not so many other distractions. And I'll show you the headline that in one game with Fennels and Cookstown, and this was not a playoff game, but it was the game that decided who was going to be in the playoffs. It's in the headline. 1,000 people were.
Yeah,
it was a community thing.
Oh yeah,
everybody was there.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it had to do with a different feeling. The Warriors were a depressing time. There were young men being killed. I had two friends that were killed overseas. It was like a new world.
And there was a good rivalry.
The rivalry went
down. Fennels, Bradford, etc.
And you knew the people who were playing on the game.
For sure.
From the teams.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's the big thing today. Like, if you go to see a Bradford hockey team, you don't know anybody. Well, you go back to Brad Ford's, you certainly knew the people who were playing. Well, in most cases, there. But not.
You know, Abe Brown, the farm just down town, young Tom's, Brown's father. He would be at every game, I expect, in Bradford, but he was at every game at Fennels. That was his pastime, old Abe. and he would sit and talk with old Herb Sr., probably both smoking a cigar.
Yeah.
Oh, it was great.
Well, Mount Pleasant had a team in,
yes,
in the league at one, and they got a pretty good crowd. Didn't they?
Yeah. Oh, sure they did. And I can,
after Bradford would go.
I can remember all those guys. Like I played for for Churchill at that time.
Yeah.
And so of course Roger and Leighton Giffen. They were a godsend to the area. Leighton was hot third baseman. Or shortstop, whatever you want to play. And then Ross Klavine pitched. Yeah. There were Lloyd and Clarence Neeshaw, both pretty decent players who aren't mentioned much anywhere, but they were very good. Mm-hmm. Joe Gordon played with them for a while.
Yes, he did.
And I just can't remember everybody else. But
according to the list, Shirley Bowles gave me a list. He said Art Neeshaw played for the...
Yes,
for
he played for Bradford.
Mount Pleasant.
He played for Mount Pleasant before he played for Bradford.
Before he came to Bradford. Yeah. Yeah, and you know, there was a guy there played for them. You know the fellow that runs the big Christmas tree farm, Doug Cotanessa?
Drysdale?
Doug Drysdale is related by marriage to the to the Moriartys that lived on the east side of the road. Yep. Harry Moriarty.
Yep.
And he worked there in the summer across from the other one. And he played ball at Mount Pleasant in the summer. That's where I first met him.
Yeah.
So, oh, geez, the memories I have. I know. Oh. All I need is somebody to open the subject and keep going.
I remember, I can't be 15 or 16. And we're playing in a tournament at Churchill.
Oh.
At your place. And here on the field is Big Blake pitching. My brother Jack's catching in an undershirt, no sleeves,
with a home roll cigarette.
And a cigarette hanging out of his mouth. And your other brother, Maggie was playing first base. Not many people remember Maggie. But
he,
I remember...
He was a good first baseman.
Sure he was. I remember as a kid, you know, I'm fast, I'm going to steal bases, all of this stuff. So I dance off first base, and I go to the back. First base. I'm not stealing. And I'm going to go back. He steps right on my foot. And I can't get back to first base.
He had his right knee.
The son of a gun, he'd have his right leg out there for sure.
And you're trying to get around his knee.
He was 6 foot three or four. He had a great stretch.
Didn't he?
But, you know, and going back before I forget the fact, you know, and there isn't any doubt about that Harry Coe set the standard for the league. And he rose the bar. And in many ways, we came up to the bar.
Yes, Ken.
But, you know, my brother Mac, for Churchill, at least, he never played other place because he died when he was 36. He could hit Harry.
Yeah.
A lot of people. Often Jack would, maybe the old Jack was a good hitter, but Mac seemed to, whether it was his height or what was, he could figure out Harry's changeup in speed. I'll never forget that.
What was his right name?
Mackenzie. Alexander Mackenzie, actually. Historical name.
You're referring to as Maggie,
Maggie. Yeah, well, you know, and that's something that's worth mentioning, because my brother Bill, the oldest boy in the family, he was a bit of a kidder, you know. Serious. He ended up, he was a policeman, actually. But he always had this habit, and each one of us, of his younger brothers, had a nickname. And Jack was next to him, and he was called Cogan, or Coog, we called him. And my brother Mac was called Maggie. My brother Ralph, who died when he was 20, and was a good ball player, well, never had much chance. He was Ryer. Now, where he got Ryer from, I don't know. And I was either Buckwheat or Chucks. So, but the Bill tagged us all with our nicknames.
Well, I've often claimed, Blake, that I played ball in Newmarket, Toronto, softball, and all around that. And if I had to pick, well, there was two, maybe three guys. But one of the best hitters was your brother, Jack.
Oh, yeah.
Because marvelous hitter. He was so strong in the arms.
And quick.
And quick. He didn't have to go like this.
Very seldom hit a home run, but I can tell you, he understood Texas leaguers. They were over the infield, but sharp.
I thought he was a marvel. The other one was that I played with was we called him Joint, Bill McComb. He played pro hockey, and he played for, he pitched for Newmarket Vets, but he was a left-handed hitter. And he was a long ball hitter. He'd strike out a lot more than Jack.
Yeah. And very seldom Jack could strike out.
No. Marvelous hitter.
But I've got, you know, I've got Kenyon. This is all Barry Examiner stuff, you know. And the stuff I have here, George, it reaches from 1936 to 1960.
Oh, wow, wow.
And why, how come I got it? My sister-in-law, Bill's wife, she talk about a fan. Mm-hmm. She, you know, if she wasn't at the game, she had to pay. She cut all these things out of the Barry paper. And it glorifies some people and their good days and their bad days, but yeah, everybody had a fair play. And, mm-hmm, and I have these all copied. These are all for historical need if there's any place to file them. Because Ken, you'll acknowledge that the Bradford witness? They didn't do a good job.
I agree.
But well, Barry, you know, did. And here was the guy that was responsible, George Story, because he was Red's brother, and he played ball for one of the Barrys. But he replied the game. That's why he made them exciting.
I said there had to be somebody who was really interested.
Oh, yeah.
And then he started to write, and then he found he had a following, and then it goes. That's
but the truth of the matter is, the South Temple League was far more exciting than you'll recall, Ken, that about the mid 50s, then we begin to have the interlocking league, and finally, then as the South Temple League gradually tapered down, then I start to pitch for Bradford, and we were in the league with three or four Barry teams and Minnesing and Bradford. I've got clips on the wall.
There's a picture of 1953. When Bradford won, it wasn't called Citizen. It was the Simcoe County League. And I recall that the Air Force out of Camp Borden had a team. They were in it. Barry was in it.
There's Pat Poland. Ross Cabine, Well, I started to pitch for that Bradford team. Yes. I don't know whether you can recall or not, Ken, but towards the end of the glory days of South Simcoe League, for a year, we tried an interlocking schedule. And it was a very busy year, mm-hmm, because we not only had our own schedule, but we worked some of these teams in. I can remember pitching against Leo Labine, and Ron Stewart, and those guys, because they were in Fellows Park playing for Barry team.
Yeah, Ray Garrity.
And Ray Garrity. Yeah. And it was fun to strike some of those guys out, because Leo Labine wasn't a bad pitcher, but he's a bad-tempered young guy.
No, wasn't.
And I can remember striking him out, and he took his bat, and I thought he's going to throw it through the net.
That was good ball.
Oh,
but
yeah,
that was
yeah.
Good ball. They were a good team.
But I've got clippings reflecting all those eras, fellas, and I don't know what to do with them, but I thought, I don't know whether you've got a library here or not, George, but they're yours for anybody that wants to refer to them. It's quite amazing. And there's the one, and this is, I talked about this game, Ken.
Yes.
That was a game that was going to decide whether Cookstown, I think it was Fennel's, was in the playoffs that year. We weren't at the top, I think. But that's when you could, that's a 1,000 watch deciding 3-2 game.
Oh, well,
and we won that one, Cookstown.
Yeah.
That was in 1949.
I guess I was playing with Bradford then.
Oh, you would be.
Yeah.
Oh, well, your name will be mentioned. The teams were all mentioned.
Yeah. But you remember Tottenham being in?
Oh, yeah, I have
Billy
stuff
Thornton.
On that.
Billy Thornton was
Bill
the pitcher.
Thornton. Yeah. Wait till I show you his face. Look, I've got, this is 36. This is the late 40s. Now, these are the games, during the late 40s, I pitched for Churchill, and my talk about Jack Medical was he teed off to me because Pat Pullen There was a fair value league going then, including CNR, Price's Grill, Stewart's Lunch, and one thing another, and
Air Force.
And Air Force and Utopia. So they needed a second string pitcher. Well, so I would, Pat would pick me up in the police cruiser. I worked for my Uncle George at Fifth Line and take me and I'd pitch the game. But there's all kinds of, I got more pitching than I could handle. That.
Jack, he said,
what are you doing up there?
I may have mentioned this to George, but I don't see you that often. But there was a time of going to Camp Borden with Pat Pullman. Okay, so I'm 21 years of age or 22, and I've just been appointed a Justice of the Peace.
Yeah.
Pat's upstairs. He's round the open. And we're both playing for Bradford. Not this team, I guess, or the year before, yeah. Whatever. So Pat says, well, we're going to be late. We're going to be late. And he had his black uniform. You remember, you had to wear a black uniform.
Black top.
So he had it, and he went and changed out in the garage. Township office. I went home and got the uniform, put it on or something, back out there. He says, we'll take the unmarked police cruiser. Oh, okay, Pat. And he says, you drive. I'm driving. He's sitting here. We're going up 400 Highway. Put your foot down. We got to get there.
Yeah.
I'm driving. I'm driving a police cruiser going 80 or 85 miles an hour. And then we tear into the entrance, you know, and they stopped you.
Oh, yeah. And then, not now.
And old PJ had his Sergeant Please. Shield or whatever.
Oh,
heck,
yeah.
Whatever the heck it was. He's hanging it out, and the guy goes, one.
I tell you, that was just as scary, Ken. Like, I often went up when we were doing that with Fred Dow. You know what Fred was. Mm-hmm. I think he had a 5-passenger coupe, if I remember. And Fred would be, we were all excited about the ball game. You know? And Fred would be driving like mad up there and turn around to talk to those guys in the back. You know, keep your eyes on the road, Fred, whatever you do. But we had some good times out there. I remember a game that was rained out that was. We were treated royally at the Sergeant Mess.
Where did you play the early games? There was a good discussion about the early games at Fennel's. There was a ball diamond across the Herbie Hughes' farm.
I don't remember it. It's in some of my notes, and I'm going to clear these notes up because I'm a scribbly writer. I brought all this stuff, and I'm going to. I was 15, and that was 1940. I had been, well, no, it'd be 41 because I was 16 the June of that. So that would be, I was 15 going on 16. And Bradford was in the league, Newton Robinson. You hadn't moved up this way.
No.
This was 1941. Mm-hmm. And there was Stroud. And anyway, I had pitched ball. Like, from the time I was five, I watched Jack Reeve, who was an excellent ball pitcher. And I never had any doubt in my mind that I wanted to be a ball player. So my dad had played ball in his youth. And so that was okay with him. So we had more backyard ball with us boys than most families. But anyway, then when I went and in public school and high school, I was always the pitcher. So then I started working that summer for my brother Jack on the farm. And who do you think came along to talk to me? It was Ken Bell. Yeah, and because Ken and I, we both had an eye on the O'Neill girls.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, he said, Blake, you should go down to Fennel's. They need another pitcher. Gordon knew she was pitching. And so I went down to watch a game there, and that was the first time I ever saw Joe McGanney, and he hit a big homer that night. But I indicated I wanted to play, so then I played about four or five games up until about the middle of June, or around my birthday. I had an appendix. Surgery, so that ended my ball career. But I remember playing in Bradford and against Mount Pleasant, a different team. But I was only 15, until my birthday on the 28th of June. So that was my start. But then I got to say, and I said it in my speech, I don't know what you got from Minnesota, but it was just an encapsulated thing. Mm-hmm. I said a lot there. And I wouldn't mind saying it again. 44, had been, but from then on, in the heat of the war, the interest died. Churchill had a team, and then all of a sudden they didn't have a team. There weren't there wasn't farm help. And the Reeve boys, I can remember watching a Churchill team with four Reeves on it and five constables. That was my four brothers plus my Uncle George, who was a trucker that I bought out in a ball game at Churchill. So it ebbed down, but then it started to flourish again. Towards the end, there was more optimism, and it came back, and of course, you know how well it went from about 44 right through.
So when did they start? there have been two diamonds at Fennel's. There was one before the one that they have now.
Okay, what is now, I can tell you exactly what happened, George. What is that first ball game when I went to Domagany, that was played on the old Brown property where they now park. And it belonged to the Brown family, but it hadn't been used, and they allowed the Fennel's ball team to use it. I never remember seeing a game on Herb Hughes' farm, though I know it was there. But anyway, then, with the increasing interest, and yet, you know, we have to take our hats off in a lot of ways to Jack Hughes, because he was such a promoter, mm-hmm. such an enthusiast about ball, mm-hmm. you know, and he talked the Kells, and, you know, my brother-in-law Keith there, because mm-hmm. they owned the land west of there, right down towards where Zelkies are farming, mm-hmm. that 25 acres or so. He could see that the thing was growing, and he talked to the Kells. The Kells were good community people. They sold that entrance from the north by the hydro transformer line on 89, that right away, and where the park now is, to the ball club, for how much money?
$1.
$400. And which wasn't really much. And they were ardent farmers. They didn't want to part with it at all, but Jack talked into it. So anyway, then, of course, you know, the different things have happened since then. But what a wonderful move it was. Then, if you'll allow me to finish this, because this is really important, the other piece of property still belonged to the Browns. And we had been using, and that was shortly after we got the Kell property, we put the lights in, and we were the first 10. And Art Evans helped us get the poles from the Edgar Raider station. Yeah. And we trucked them down, and we sold tickets. And Matt, Ev, Nisha were all selling tickets. And we raised $6,700. I sold $1,100 worth of tickets from this draw. We had them with us all the time. But we got them in there, and the corner boys from Lefroy, you know, we remember yes. Lefroy played.
Yes.
They did the wiring for nothing. So we got lights. we thought we had really done something.
What was the prize for the draw?
Oh, I don't know, it was $1,000 or something like that. But we sold, and then there was a big party and the whole thing like that. But you know, they sold pretty well because the interest had grown. And you could sell those tickets. Mm-hmm. At that time, they were $10, which was a bit of money at that time,
sure.
really, you know.
Yeah, sure.
So that's what happened. But when I think back, there was no one person any more energetic about it than Jack Hughes. He had the vision of it.
What year would that be?
I had come back. I never played in the old Fennel's Diamond until I come back from Gravenhurst, which was in 1946. So that transaction happened while I was there, so I would say it would probably be around 1946, 43 or 4 in there. Did you ever play in the old Fennel's Diamond?
I can't
no.
remember playing.
So it would be in the early 40s.
And the lights came in about 47?
I'd say they came in a little... yeah, I think so. Yeah, it would be. After I was playing at Fennel's. I started playing for Fennel's again in 49, though I didn't move to Fennel's till 50. And it was after I was there that we put the lights in. Yeah, I would think you're right. Around 47, 48 in there. But it was pretty exciting stuff, the lights.
Oh, that was a big deal.
Yeah. And you had lights in Bradford here at the same time or before that?
Later.
After Fennel's.
Yeah, because I remember the story.
I think I said before.
Well, don't worry about that.
No. Because I remember, and then Art Evans was instrumental in getting the same deal for you fellows. So that's how I know the sequence. No. It wasn't long after. But I want to tell you something more. I got to tell you this. And if I'm talking too much, just say, Blake, shut up. You recall, Ken, when Bradford took the old radar control posts out of the ground and put the new lights in the Bradford Park. The top of the poles had been cut off. I never know where they took them. They took the roots out of the ground, all the stumps, and they, on a town truck, they brought them all up to the landfill site that I was managing. And they had all been pressure treated. They were BC red cedar. That's what they were. BC red cedar. So I thought, God, we're not going to bury them. So I had them pile them all in a separate place there, you know. And they laid there for years. And they just laid there. Well, then I was retiring from there, and I thought, something's going to... And now I'd probably end up in jail for saying this. But those things had been laying there. At that time, it hadn't cost them anything to dump. And I hired, who was it, with a loader truck. And I took them, about the time that Susan and I were going, I took them up to the milling place, to out on 90 Highway there.
Yeah, the lumber guy there.
Yeah. He saw them. Well, you know. We saw them, and then I took them to another place and had them trimmed down. They are now in the back deck on our house. And they're by far better. We didn't have enough to do. And they're so much better than the other cedar we bought to finish that you would not believe it. Can you imagine that? They'd been in the ground. The red cedar, tar-treated bottom. They must be in the ground for 40 years, Ken. Can you believe that?
As long as the air doesn't get out. Okay.
Yeah. Everybody thought I was crazy.
any post, you think, any post, that where the area where it gets to decay is where it meets the ground. And you get the combination of air and water and frost.
But, you know, the texture of them, everything about them is just a really nice quality. But we're off the track, George.
No, you're not. So let me ask you a question. I have lost track of what happened to Jerry Prike.
Jerry Prike was, as you know, was a wonderful ball player.
Oh, a nice guy.
And a power hitter.
Oh, yeah.
And he had played professional football with Sarnia Imperials.
Yeah.
And he worked at the Avril.
Yeah.
And when the government scrapped the Avril, he was out of a job. And he moved to the States. He's deceased, of course.
He ended up
in San Francisco, which he said was the loveliest place he probably ever lived in. He used to come up once in a while.
He did, because he dropped in to see me one time when he was up, and I thought that was just great of him.
But before do you want to see him? This is
that's Jerry there.
Oh, he was a solid guy.
Yeah.
But I want to tell you something. At one of the 24th of May ball tournaments. I don't know whether Bradford was there or not, but Hap Ames was coaching the Barry Flyer today. So they had this Barry team down there with a few of the junior A hockey players on it. And I can't even remember who was umpiring, but there was a big rhubarb because an start by Hap Ames because he said there was a bad call against his team. And they started to rabble rouse, and we thought the whole damn park was going to explode. And do you know what happened? Derek Fried come over, and he jumped on the bench, because we didn't even have risers in, and he grabbed half the ends like that. Now he said, are you going to put up or shut up? This is, so help me God, this is what happened. And I can tell you the thing just a few seconds. Oh. I never thought I'd see the day.
I like Derek.
Oh, he was a great guy.
Oh, yeah. Certainly he was. Yeah. Now, you mentioned something, and something that we run into in the paper here are these tournaments. You said was there an annual 24th of May ball
tournament? They used to most frequently be held at Churchill on the 24th of May weekend. Whatever that happened to be. But then later on, we started to have an imbalance. Because there wasn't as, later on, there wasn't quite as much ball interest in Churchill. Yeah. Yeah, but they were exciting days, really.
Yeah. I noticed there's also was I don't know if you were involved in a ball tournament that was held at the same time as the 12th of July, like for the Orange Bowl.
No, I can't remember. There were ball tournaments held sometimes in Innisfil Park on the 1st of July.
This is 1932.
I was only 7 then.
Fennels wins the softball tournament.
Oh, yeah.
Teams competed. Oh, Fennels, yeah. Cookstown, Judy Robinson, Glen Cairn, Elm Grove, Churchill Jr.
Now, I want to tell you something about the Churchill Juniors, because I'm the only one living that knows. Because the time is right. Now I got to tell you.
Where's Tim?
Oh, he's just gone to the washroom.
He's not wanted to hear this.
Okay. All right. Well,
tell me what you mentioned.
Okay,
John.
Here we have it. This is 1932. In the softball tournament, 8 teams competed. Fennels, Cookstown, Newton Robinson, Glen Cairn, Elm Grove, Churchill Juniors, Bradford had 2 teams. After preliminary rounds were over, Fennels and Norm McLeod's Bradford team were left in the running to fight it over. The former winning a good game by 2-0 score. So Fennels won over Bradford.
1932.
Norman and Fred McLeod. I remember seeing them play. My brother Bill and Jack do. This McLeod's Hill up here. Right?
Yeah.
But anyway, you talk about the Churchill Juniors. Jack Constable, Bill Constable, apparently Sloan, the deaf mute, you know, he was on that team. Marshall Reeve, the uncle of Ralph and Jack and Tom, Bill Brown. Anyway, and Lloyd Graham. Ernie Watch was a good third baseman. He was on the 6th of Dennis. They were in a league with Bradford. And I'm talking the year 1930. And Barry only had 2 teams at that time. They were small. They were only about 8,000 people. The Allendale Imperials, named after the Imperial Theater, and the Roxy Aces, named after the Roxy Theater. And so the Roxy sponsored the Roxy Aces, and Dick Garrett, who run the Imperial, he sponsored the Allendale Imperials. So it was Bradford, Churchill, the 2 Barry teams, and Midhurst. And I don't think Utopia at that time. But I was 5 years old, and I wasn't even at the game, but I'll never forget that night, and I say it in my speech here. Churchill beat the final game against the Allendale Imperials for they called the Central County Championship at that time. Bill and Jack were playing, the Reeve boys, and all these, and the picture sits up in the Churchill Hall there, if you're ever there. I want to get a copy of it for myself. Jack was 18. That time, and Bill would be 2 years older. But anyway, and I tell you, talk about excitement. Churchill beat them. And have you ever heard the name of Ken Guilfoyle? Because if you haven't, like, it was a miracle that they beat him. He was a good pitcher, and he pitched, you know, in the southern United States, they had professional fastball, and he pitched there after leaving Barry. But Jack could hit him again. He had this fabulous drop, but he couldn't fool Jack, and that made the difference. But they won that, and they were the senior team. But here's my brother, Mac. Now we start to get to the point. Lloyd Hughes, Vern Hughes had helped, that died. He had helped with that 30s win. But between him and Jack Reeve, they were both good pitchers. But Jack was older than Earl Steele lived at Steele's Corners at the 14th there. And I can remember as if it was yesterday, Lloyd Hughes and Earl Steele drove into our farmyard at the 7th line of Ennisville to see Mac, my brother Maggie. Would you be interested in forming a junior ball team? Oh, yeah. They hadn't had a chance to play with the senior team, you see. And that worked good. They had, what the heck was his name? And Coach Brown got the catch. So in about 31 and 2, not much longer than that, or maybe to 33, Churchill Jr. And Don Beatty. They were guys that were really keen and bald, but they hadn't cut it with the senior team.